I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A powerful, resourceful, and much-needed book is The Heart Does Break, Canadian Writers on Grief and Mourning. It's a collection of remarkable essays about death from some of Canada's best-known writers. Those whose writing is featured include Brian Brett, Austin Clark, Frank Davey, Jill Frayn, Joan Givner, Marnie Jackson, Paul Querington, and Stephen Reed, among many others. The collection is edited by George Bowring and Jean Baird, who sought a book like this when Ms. Baird's daughter, Bronwyn, died suddenly. Joining me now are George Bowring and Jean Baird. She is the head of the Alperdi A-Frame Trust and is an English professor and a former magazine publisher. George Bowring is a poet, novelist, essayist, critic, historian, and editor. He was Canada's first parliamentary poet laureate. The book, The Heart Does Break, is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, George Bowring and Jean Baird. Good morning, Ms. Baird.
Good morning.
And good morning, Mr. Bowring.
Hey. hey, one correction. It's not a book of stories about death. It's a story about people going on living after the death of somebody.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, the mourning process, grief and all that, it's invariably about the person who's still here, I guess, right? More than the person who died. Do you find that that's the case?
Yeah,
it's a complicated relationship, though, because it is a relationship, right? It's not just about the person who's dead. It's about your relationship with that person. So it's you, but it's definitely a relationship situation.
Yeah. When your daughter died, Jean, because I found this so fascinating that you sought solace in literature. Did you turn to writing in times of sadness, but also in times of joy?
I guess I turned to writing always.
Yeah.
If I remember a few years ago deciding to get a dog, well, you go to the library and get books on dogs to read and find out which dog is going to suit your life. So it's a response I have about everything, regardless of happy or sad. To me, my whole life, books have been a resource, a way of figuring out the world. So that's my inclination always. But what happened, I was sitting, my son went to a counselor for a while. He and his sister were very, very close. They were 6 years apart, but she was as much a surrogate mom in ways as she was a big sister. And I went with him to one of these sessions, and I was sitting, and I saw this huge rack of books sitting there. And I thought, wow, I bet there's all sorts of things in there that would help me, would tell me something. And the counselor who my son was seeing actually went with me to Banyan Books because her son had died about 10 years ago. And she just went through the bookshelf in the section on grief and mourning and said, well, this one takes this approach, and this one is sort of self-help, and this is a Buddhist approach, and so on. And I just bought this huge collection of books and brought them home and started reading. And I found something in all of them, but most of them, the heart of what was being said left me pretty cold. It was clinical.
Yeah, it wasn't writing.
Well, and the writing quality was not very good.
Yeah. George, do you turn to writing as well? Like, in by writing now, I mean practicing it itself.
Yeah, you know, I like to say that this book is, to me, it's as important for its writing as it is for its topic, if it were possible to separate those things. What I'm saying is that I think there's an audience for this book made up of people who just like really good Canadian writing, really good Canadian prose writing. So it's not just a book for, I mean, I think it's a wonderful idea that all kinds of people I've talked to are buying copies of it for people who have recently been bereaved. But I think it's also really important that I wouldn't have wanted to do this book if the writing had not been really good literature.
Yeah. And how does this come together? Who had the idea first, you or Jean?
Jean.
Yeah.
Well, after months of reading, And I figured out fairly quickly that the books that were having the most resonance for me were books by creative writers,
yeah.
not the books by that on the title it had PhD after the author's name,
mm-hmm.
or and the Buddhist approach, you know, which is great learning only comes through great pain, so sort of bring it on. You know, there was certainly learning going on in my life, but there's something kind of a little disturbing about that approach, too. But it was the books by creative writers, Joan Didion. It was Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking. Someone
yeah.
gave that book to me after the first couple of weeks after Brahman had died. For weeks, I couldn't read anything. I mean, I couldn't. I would read the same sentence over and over
yeah.
again. But The Year of Magical Thinking was the first book I was really able to read. And then I found Catherine Ashenberg's absolutely wonderful book called The Mourner's Dance, where
mm-hmm.
she looks at mourning rituals all over the world and through different centuries. And that book might have saved me, if that's not too sort of melodramatic. But from Catherine's book, then I found Thomas Lynch, The Undertaking. So I was figuring that out, and I was saying to George, but where are all the Canadian writers on this? Because I'm reading all these American and, you know, British books. And that's when we started to look, and we found lots of elegies and odes, but no real bulk. And what I wanted to happen was articulation of grief that went beyond clinical words like closure. Closure is just nonsense. That's not what happens. You have a child died, there's no closure. It doesn't mean you're dysfunctional or you're not dealing with it, and that word bothers me as well. And that happened. Every single piece that came in, although they were all so different, every single one of them, when I read it, I thought, aha, that's it. They've articulated something that I felt. You know, it's that so often thought but ne'er so well expressed. And these writers, every single one of them nailed something for me. I thought,
and it was
yes,
always
that's
something
it.
Different. Although there were certain themes that kept coming up, like a number of people did complain about that notion of closure, or the notion that somehow or another this is something to get over and that time will heal and all that business. Those are cliches, and the people that we were dealing with were people who write fresh language, who are used to understanding how language informs the world of the people who are reading it, and it was very varied. Everybody was finding something, as Gene says, but the stories are so varied. There are even some that that have, you know, thigh slapping laughs in them, if you can imagine.
These authors that are in the book, they've all experienced loss. Was that a rule, perhaps, that they had to write about someone that was close to them that they'd lost?
Oh yeah, yeah. And there were other like ones that were really obvious candidates for us that we really wanted to have, and people who found they couldn't do it. And that was, we understood that fully. There were others who thought maybe they couldn't do it and then changed their mind and were really glad that they had done it. And so were we, of course.
Yeah.
To sort of refer to an earlier question, it was very interesting to me when I got in touch with people and said, this is how this idea came about, and we would like you to write a piece about, you know, your father, your sister, your brother, whatever it was. Almost every single writer responded and said, this is a great idea for a book.
Yeah.
And you're right, I've never written about this, and I should, and I know why I should. I remember a few years ago, a panel, and I think, George, it was you and Stan Persky and Susan Musgrave and maybe someone else, and the person asked this panel of writers, why do you write? And I don't know whether it was Stan or Susan answered and said, well, that's what I do. That's how I figure out the world. What I can't understand is why the rest of you don't write.
Yeah.
Like, how do you figure out the world?
Yeah.
So all of these writers, that was the response. What was most startling was some of the very best writers in this country said, I can't do it. I'm wordless. And to me, that really informed as well to say, a writer whose tools are words, that grief leaves people words, and unfortunately we seem to have this instinct to comfort and want to say things, and as a result we say horrible things, and not intentionally. I had a cousin send me a card to say, I must be thrilled to know that Bromnell was in the arms of Jesus. Well, no, actually, I wasn't thrilled. And I know her intent was that's where she finds comfort in her life. But it's words are extremely powerful, and unfortunately, in times of grief, we don't always use them really well.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes less is more.
You talk about that, George, in your essay in the front of the book, about the things that people said to Jean after Bronwyn died, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just awful things like
that. Yeah, they said totally unthinking things, and characteristically those things would be in cliches that that people think somehow or another are going to ease that person's days after the death and during the ceremony and so forth. And that's why it's so interesting to see what the writers can do, because the writers, they don't deal in cliches. Writers' job is to wage a war against cliches that only deaden language and deaden feelings and deaden the relationship between you and the world. And have you looked at the cover of the book and see? We looked at the cover of the book and thought, what is that? Oh, it's so green. Oh, it's a grave.
Yeah.
And that the combination of the green and the grave is tremendously important to me, I think. I love that cover.
Yeah.
Here we are talking about the cover of the book.
Yeah. it is. Like, you don't notice the coffin in this tombstone at all.
All of a sudden, you're seeing the grave from above, and it's whoever got that image and decided that it would illustrate what we were doing was some kind of genius, I think.
You
said the book was about death. George said the book was about grief. A lot of the letters we're getting from people who've read it are saying the book's about life.
Yeah.
And it is, because faced with that, and it isn't, and death isn't always devastating. It depends on your relationship with that person. When my father died, I was certainly sad and upset, but it didn't stop me in the track. My tracks, as the death of my daughter does. So your death is always a different experience depending on your relationship with the person who died, but you're still faced with that job.
Yeah.
And the job is for you to go on living, and often that requires a lot of work figuring out how to do it without that person. In Frank Davies' piece in the book, he talks about when B.P. Nichol died, all of these things that they were going to do, all of these projects that now weren't going to happen. And Frank had to sort of rethink his writing life, because so much of it was wound up in the stuff he did with B.P., and that wasn't there anymore. Whereas in Brian Fawcett's piece in the book, his dad died just short of his 101st birthday. Well, his relationship with his dad had become so vibrant and vital in the last 10 years of his dad's life that he was mourning something that for the first number of years of his dad's relationship wasn't there. So, you know, every experience of death is different, and when we start to put it in boxes and use words like stages of grief, it dishonors grief, and I think what we aren't good at in this society is honoring grief and validating it for people. And you know, so you shouldn't say to someone, well, you need to get on with your own life.
No.
You need to say, it's okay to feel sad and really messy and unpredictable because someone you dearly, dearly loved died, you know?
Jean, how has Bronwyn's death affected your writing?
Well, I'm not a writer, and that's why I don't have a piece in the book,
because
that would be a cheat. And a lot of people urged me to do that, and I said, no, that's not what it's about. I've certainly written lots of things over the years, but I don't think of myself as a writer. And that's what I really wanted, was the words of writers, because I so much value what they can do with those very powerful tools.
You're sure a good editor, though, lady.
Well, but it certainly has changed me profoundly, I think.
Yeah.
I have little patience for things that I used to invest a lot of time in, and I have come to deeply, deeply value things that I valued before, but I think I'm much more mindful of articulating those things and articulating those things to the people.
Yeah, it was sure good that you had those authors to help you do that, too.
This is the book I'm glad I have it now, but it's the book that I really wished I'd had shortly after Bronwyn died, and it's gratifying to have it being so well received by people.
Yeah.
And gratifying to hear, I had an email this morning from someone who's actually my sister's friend, who got it because her brother died unexpectedly, and she's saying she's sort of sobbing her way through the essays, but she is also finding it, and the words comfort and support, again, they just aren't quite the right fit. And you see, that's why I'm not the writer. I can't find the right word to explain what the essays are doing. But I guess what they're doing is validating people's sadness and not supplying them with a cliche response.
Yeah, this is it's an interesting book in terms of those returns we've been getting. That we've been getting really good reviews in the magazines and newspapers, but we're also getting all kinds of messages sent to us from a publisher, from people who've written to them. There was a woman who had lost like three close members of her family, and she bought the book in Victoria, I think it was, and she just sat down and read the whole book from beginning to end, and it's 300 and some odd pages, and things like that. It's just you always do like to hear from readers, no matter what you've published, but in this instance, it's really gratifying to hear from those people, how happy they are, or not happy, but how glad they are that they had such a book for them.
Yeah.
A lot of people are reading it and then going out and buying extra copies and giving them to the local funeral home and to the minister in their church. And,
yeah.
I got a letter yesterday from someone who said she'd bought three copies and given them to all of the hospice in the area where she lives. So I guess that my sense of discouragement in not finding such a book is now being changed by all these other people being so happy in finding this book.
Yeah.
George, were there contributors in the book that talked about religion and what that meant to them in terms of grief?
It's curious. Like, there's very little. Gene and I were talking about that one time with somebody, I can't remember who it was, but we sort of looked back on it and thought, hey, you're right, there's hardly anything to do with religion in the book at all. There are some rituals that could attend to religion. There's one that tells you all about a Jewish funeral in Montreal. But in terms of, I don't know, finding some kind of solution or some kind of assuagement or something like that, no. That was curiously hardly any of that there at all. Not that it would, I suppose. I don't want to put off anybody who's like has a thoroughly religious view of life, but no, there is very little of that.
I think the only piece that sort of even alludes to it is the one by George Eliot Clarke.
Mm, oh yeah.
But it's not. Someone said a week or so ago, if this were a book by American writers, there'd be all sorts of God and religion in it, and I'm not sure that's true, but. And I didn't particularly notice its absence. We certainly didn't instruct people in any way. But it's not really there.
Yeah. Regret, that's something that I see throughout the book, throughout the essays. How normal is it to be regretful or angry about it?
Oh, I think that's often the response. If someone... And this happened, for example, with Erin Murray, who was very, very close to her mother. They knew her mother had cancer and that she was dying. And Erin made huge efforts to spend enormous amounts of time with her mother in the last few years. And I don't think that Erin has regrets. She certainly misses her mother deeply. Her mother was 84 when she died, and at the funeral people said, well, she had a good long life, which is another one of those things that people say, right? And Erin said, well, that's true. It doesn't make me miss her any less. But I don't think that Erin has any regrets. But a sudden death, when you don't have, I guess, that opportunity to say goodbye and to let that person know how much you love them, there's regrets,
I suppose. That certainly happened to Frank Davy that you mentioned before. Frank was in France when Barry died as on an operating table. And he was only 44, and they had all, and he was just reaching, I don't know, some kind of, like, when you, writers usually get really good in their 40s, and so Frank was obviously regretting, A, the fact that he was way over in Europe when this happened, and B, that they did have a lot of projects in mind, and they knew there would be other projects that they hadn't even thought of yet, so that's obviously one case of regret, I think.
This sounds silly as I think about this next question, but does putting this together, perhaps, I mean, you talk about how you wish it was there when you suffered your own loss. Does it prepare you for death at all? Like, if someone dies now, do you know what to do? Do you know what to say?
I don't think you ever do, even if you think you do. But it's interesting you ask that question, because when I got in touch with Paul Corrington, and I was reading Paul's book about the Galapagos Islands, and there's just a throwaway line in there that's necessary to the narrative of the story, but is there just to explain how his father's wife is not Paul's mother, that Paul's mother had died. And however he mentions this, it just hit me, and I thought, wait a minute, his mother must have died like when he was a teenager. Then I started thinking about of all Paul's other books and Absent Mums and stuff. Anyway, when I wrote Paul and asked him if he would write about his mother dying when he was 15, and Paul at the time was, you know, in his mid-50s, he said, it's funny you should ask, because people have been telling me for years I should write about it, and actually that's what I set out to do on my last novel, that's The Ravine. And the story sort of got sideswiped by something else. So, yes, I'll do it. And he did, and he finished the piece, and we had to sort of nudge him a whole bunch. Wonderful writer to work with, and I love Paul's writing, but we really had to nudge him a whole bunch to get the piece. And it was a couple of months after the piece came in that Paul himself was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And Paul died January of this year, just after the book came out. But someone else who knew Paul really well was wondering, not because Paul had said so, but was wondering, having read Paul's piece, if the writing of that piece informed the way Paul lived the rest of his life after that diagnosis. And I, of course, don't have the answer to that, but Paul sure gave us one hell of an example of how to deal with a cancer diagnosis and how to live and celebrate and articulate what you were feeling. And he did that in such a public and very profound way, right down to the instant that he died. So,
yeah, he was a musician too, and he even put out a MP3 of a song about facing death, which is an absolutely splendid, marvelous, wonderful song. And that was one of the last pieces of writing he ever did, I guess. Mm-hmm. But when you hear his voice on it, it's just astonishing how alive he sounds.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it's prepared me for, you know, my own death or the death of the others, you know, the other dear friends and loved ones as my years tick on. But I think it's helped.
Yeah. George, you mentioned earlier what a good editor Gene is.
Yeah.
In putting this book together, and in particular your piece, did you write it first and then give it to her, or was it something that she had input in throughout?
Oh, you know, I can't really remember, but I remember that she insisted that I write one, and she insisted that it be of a certain length, and I sat and I wrote it over a period of maybe a week, I suppose, week and a half, something like that. And I experienced, like while I was writing it, I felt as if I knew what I knew what I was doing, which is not, I can tell you, always true. It was as if I was doing it for Jean.
Yeah.
And at her behest, and so that's one of the reasons why she's such a good editor, I think, is that she makes you have that response.
And working together, is that something you both enjoy?
Oh yeah, yeah, and we're thinking about other projects.
Yeah.
And well, Jean did this incredible project for my birthday a few years back when she got 70 some odd people to write a piece for me to publish in a book to present to me for my birthday without my even knowing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another example of good editing. It was just I was really astonished by the thing when I saw it. I couldn't believe it.
When Bronwyn was 18, 19, 20, there was a period of 18 or 20 months. We lived in a small little place in Ontario, right on the Welland Canal, called Port Colborne. And in that space of 18 or 20 months, I lost track. 8-10 funerals, maybe, she went to. The first one was a suicide. There were some car accidents. It got to the point we were afraid to pick up the phone. The community, and in a small community, every death touches you because you know everybody. You know, it might be the father of your bank teller or whatever, but you know everybody, even if it's not intimately, you know everybody. The community became so concerned that they actually held a meeting and they had the Niagara Health Unit come and all of the ministers, and they said, you know, what's wrong here? And the sad news was that in the end they said, well, you may be a little high, but this number of deaths in this age group is really within the national average because of car accidents and all the other things, right? And it was not until I arrived back in that area to, because Bronwyn had died, and I walked into a room full of her friends. There must have been, I don't know, George, 12 or 15 of them, and they were sitting there waiting for Bronwyn's very best friend, Jen, who at that time was in Taiwan. And Jen was flying back to Canada to be there for the funeral of her very best friend. And it hit me, like I can't explain, that this is not the first time these kids have done this, that all of these kids have been through this before with friends, and I realized how much I had underestimated the impact of grief on my own daughter. And believe me, I'll never do that again. I will never underestimate the impact of grief on someone. And in the instance of one kid, Bronwyn, and this was a kid who had committed suicide, and Bronwyn said, why didn't anybody do anything? So I guess I did this book for Bronwyn, because once we figured out, or I figured out, this sort of hole in the publishing world, I thought, this is something I can do something about. So to me, the book is a huge tool, and I'm glad that it is beautifully written, wonderfully crafted, some of the best writers in this country, and some writers who will be new voices to many readers, and we did that deliberately. We wanted to use the book as a way for better-known writers to approach this topic, but also a lot of writers that, for a lot of readers, will be new voices and ones they don't know, but we think are fabulous writers, to introduce those to more readers. But for me, it's a tool both to sort of honor my daughter, and because we aren't good as a society at honoring death and recognizing how it clobbers you, just can really clobber you. So we're hoping that the language and approach of this book will perhaps make us, as those supporting mourners, be a little more sensitive.
And that's so true, and this is such a great book. It's been such a pleasure to talk to both of you today. It's such a meaningful book, and I'm sure you've helped a lot of people already, Jean and George. Congratulations with it. Continued good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Heart Does Break, Canadian Writers on Grief and Mourning. It's published by Random House. George Bowring and Jean Baird, its editors, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.